Okay, I hope you're not going to allow us to get away with saying the things that we've said without appropriate challenge. So, John, to you.
Thank you. A question on the free trade agreements with Latin American countries. The National Interest had an article I see on a subject I see very little addressed. The free trade agreements obligate the Latin countries not to have any protectionism against subsidized U.S. agricultural exports. And that this has already had a pernicious effect. The example they drew was Jamaica, where we destroyed the dairy industry in Jamaica. These countries then have to compete with this tremendous subsidies that are given to American agriculture that then, in effect, almost dumps its goods overseas. And why do the Latin countries agree to that kind of an agreement? As I said, there's already examples. I believe Mexican corn, they had to accept our corn, which is all, everything we do is subsidized. We're not competing fairly, but they are obliged to take these, our exports. And a corollary to that is, long ago, the World Bank had a study about the success, why the Asians succeeded. And it was all based first on a prosperous agricultural sector in Asia, even Korea and Japan. General MacArthur gave peasants land in Japan for the first time. In other words, a successful, prosperous agriculture would be undermined by their signing these free trade agreements. Why do they agree to that?
This, I guess, is America's answer to the European Common Agricultural Policy, proving we can be just as bad as the Europeans.
Well,
okay. Would one of you like to respond?
Well, I guess my first reaction is that a trade agreement is a kind of a contract between two sovereigns, and you can't look at the terms of a contract in isolation from all the other terms. So I presume that however this might have been viewed from some perspectives detrimental, it was compensated by something more important. But now let me be an economist. I mean, of course, I totally disagree with that argument. Let's take an extreme case in which we said we're going to supply all your food needs for free. How on earth is that a bad thing for a country if the U.S. decided to feed it?
Well, can I answer that? We did that in Africa.
If you give a short answer.
Very short. When agricultural prices went up, Africans were starving because the recommendation by the IMF had been to forget their agriculture because they could get the stuff cheaper from us. And then the prices went up, and you remember the news reports recently. Mm-hmm. Also,
No, you're denying my thesis. My thesis is we give the food away. You're saying
I
mean, we play a game.
Okay.
We give it away and then we jack the price.
To go over here to the next
one
question.
One important point. It's a 15-year phase-in on this, so these governments signing it don't immediately have that.
My answer would have been that they may be better off if we give them things for free, but it's a bad thing for us to do.
Okay. John, I'm here to respond to John. Just so that we're not confused, we don't have a free trade agreement with Jamaica. Let me say that again. We don't have a free trade agreement with Jamaica. We have a one-way free trade arrangement by which Jamaican products enter the U.S. duty-free, called the Caribbean Basin Initiative, but we've never negotiated a free trade agreement with any of the English-speaking Caribbean countries. It's CAFTA, DR, that's it. And when it comes to this business of subsidized U.S. agricultural exports destroying agriculture in Latin countries, let's say, or other countries with whom we have free trade agreements. I mean, this is an interesting idea, but the original complaint about free trade agreements and their operation in the agricultural sphere was cheap agricultural imports, and often counter-seasonal imports even, displacing production and destroying agricultural production of certain commodities in the U.S., e.g. tomatoes in Florida and in some of the southern states. I don't know for sure. I think it's certainly worth looking into whether this is a real phenomena, what John's alluding to. I mean, I've certainly heard about it in the case of Mexico, or whether it's just another sort of backdoor way of attacking free trade agreements, not by dint of our sacrifices, but by dint of the sacrifices we are supposedly imposing on those poor, underprivileged people abroad.
While we have you at the microphone, isn't it also what you said about Jamaica? Isn't that also true of Colombia?
Yeah, we don't have a free trade agreement
with Colombia. Their goods come in free, and our goods face tariffs, and we can't even get Congress
to...
Yes, that's right.
That's exactly right. Under the Andean Trade Preference and Drug Eradication Act, as we call it now, ATPDEA, the vast bulk, like 95-97% of Colombian exports enter the U.S. at low or no duty. Our exporters' exports to Colombia face duties that range from 30-60%. The chief impact of the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, now pending before Congress and of course not ratified thanks to Nancy Pelosi and her disagreements with the Bush administration, would be essentially to lock in for Colombia permanently the trade status that they've enjoyed with the United States for nearly 20 years since the ATPDEA was first propounded by President Bush in 1989, as I recall, 1989-90. And to open their market to billions of dollars of U.S. exports that currently flow to Colombia and will still flow to Colombia, but on which our exporters paid, I think last year, a bill of something like $1.2 or $1.5 billion that they didn't need to pay to the Colombian government because we haven't ratified the agreement yet.
Okay. Thank you. Alan or Gerald, do you want to respond to that?
No, I mean, it's complicated and, you know, I mean, just the effects on NAFTA is they've their producers of agricultural commodities in some areas have been harmed competitively, and in some areas it's the opposite. But in terms of, as the ambassador said so cogently, in terms of South America, it tends to be a counter-seasonal thing. The effect of, for instance, free trade with Chile is I can get blueberries in the winter. It's nobody up here producing, except hothouse, blueberries in the winter. And so it's a total gain from both sides.
I would just agree, especially with that comment about the fact that we're not really even sure if it's just more of a way for them to attack the issue, because I don't think I've seen any dramatic reductions in production issues from these countries from agricultural bases. I mean, it's not there. So.
All right, Peter.
Peter Schramm, Ashbrook Center. Just a point of information on your 1797 John Adams.
Sure.
Takeover March 4th. I don't know who told you that, but Jefferson's point has to do with the election of 1800, which your example seemed to be pointing to. Jefferson claimed that the election of 1800 was the first time in human history wherein parties that were diametrically opposed, effectively a regime change, had an election and took power peacefully. One party took power peacefully from another party. He claimed that that had never happened before, and he claimed that was his
revolutionary. You're absolutely accurate there. I'm referring to John Adams.
Election didn't mean anything.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm just saying that the guy that was the guide at the Philadelphia Independence Hall was making that point. When he was just sort of talking about the significance of the change of regime issue as opposed to simply the establishment of the Constitution.
Yes, sir.
Tom McArdle, Investors Business Daily. This is off topic, and I may be out of line asking, but John Goodman is such an esteemed healthcare expert that I don't think we should let him leave the meeting without briefly commenting on what lies ahead if we have a President Obama and a Democratic Congress getting a hold of our healthcare system and what the global implications might be.
That's an unfair question.
In two minutes, John.
You know, just this last week, there were two studies that came out, one from the Lewin Group, another from the University of Minnesota, and they both said that whether it's McCain or Obama, we're talking about trillions of dollars. And the McCain people did something I didn't realize they had done, that they were supposed to have a clean swap of tax regimes. So today, all employer-provided health insurance avoids income taxes and payroll taxes. And what McCain originally said was, well, we're going to tax the benefits, but we're going to give everybody a credit, $5,000 per family. And apparently now McCain has said, no, we're going to keep the payroll tax there. So that adds $1 trillion to the cost of the McCain plan. So in any event, they're not going to be able to do any of this.
Right.
Absolutely not. I mean, all of Washington's money is going to the financial crisis. Nothing left over for health care. So I think we're safe for a while. But we still need to think about how to do it right once the time comes for reform. Yes?
I was going to say, using a kind of Calder-Hicks efficiency analysis from economics, if you're subsidizing agricultural goods and the farmers are being driven out, Of course, the rest of the people in the country are being helped by lower food prices, but all that's happening is that you took away the farmers' rents and redistributed it to the rest of the population, in a sense, that it's a transfer in a Calder-Hicks sense. And the other part is that things like that have negative externalities. If we suddenly unemploy farmers, how does that affect the political situation? I think I'd rather be in a country where food costs slightly more than suddenly the farmers have become unemployed. And I was wondering about what comments you might have.
Look, I wasn't advocating giving food away. It was a reductio ad absurdum. But you know, if you negotiate with somebody, you have to negotiate your side and they negotiate their side. So I'm presuming that these countries are negotiating on behalf of whatever interests it is that bear on their politics. I mean, you can't negotiate for the other side and your side. Negotiation is a managed conflict situation. So I just have to say again, you can't extract one term of a trade agreement or a contract and say, is this good or bad? It's only good and bad in terms of the whole agreement. So they've traded one thing for another, and they've made their internal political calculations. So that's all I could say. I mean,
and all I'll say is that the Germans and the Spanish would agree with you, because that's what they've done with the French.
Okay. Anyone else? Yeah.
Jeff Ganner, Council for America. I just wonder if you might discuss a little bit, what's the state of play of so-called environmental rules and labor regulations in terms of the negotiation over free trade agreements with Latin America? Are these basically have remained what we call in Washington killer amendments to the agreement, as opposed to something that is likely to be incorporated now into any treaty, especially if the elections here go as they seem to?
Yeah, Nancy Pelosi likes those amendments. Go ahead.
I'm not up to date on that as well as I should be.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, when Zelick was negotiating, he managed to get some of these things put in. He cut a deal with the Democrats. And, you know, for whatever reason, the poisoned atmosphere in Washington, or maybe Susan Schwab isn't the negotiator Zelick was, I don't know. That whatever kinds of detente existed with the congressional Democrats before, maybe because they seized power, their attitudes changed, that it isn't working anymore. So. It's not clear what they want other than to stop the agreement.
Yeah. They tend to use those to stop things.
Yeah. Because they were going in before.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? All right, let's thank the panel.